I think I'll get started. So welcome to this second part of my talk, where I'll be discussing on galactic TV sources, where I'll be discussing specifically TV shells, supernova remnants with interacting with molecular clouds, and I'll finish with a few slides about super bubbles. But first, in a previous episode, we concluded about the remnants of historical supernovae, and several people asked me how come that Theno 6 is such a unique case of if this interpretation is correct, of a supernova remnant exploding into an ordered magnetic field. I think the answer is, as I said, it's a type 1A, but it's really high above the galactic plane. In fact, it's at the latitude of plus 15, and there is only one other remnant in Green's catalog of 200 and so supernova remnants, which is as high, which is bigger, which is probably closer. So that's probably an important part of the answer, that it's a type 1A, which means that it can travel quite some distance from the galactic plane before exploding, and this one turns out to have been exploding quite high above the galactic plane. The fact that there's little gas between us and it, it's probably also related to the fact that historically this is the brightest supernova on record. That is, it was so bright that you could read by it, and it was a quarter of a full moon or something like this in brightness at night. So that was for 1006. Now I move to a number of objects where we see TeV emission with the shell type morphology. The most famous one is RxJ1713, or also known as G347.3. It has a somewhat complicated history, but it was the first to be resolved in TeV gamma rays. The gamma rays have a very good spatial correlation with non-thermal X-rays, which are shown here in the contours, with large enough angle observations, and because it's quite a bright source, we are able to obtain a very good spectrum. This shows that what initially looked like a relatively steep power law, in fact, can be shown to be a power law with a cutoff, and the power law, the low end energy end, is well described by a spectral index of around 2, with a cutoff around 10. But depends how exactly you want, what formula you want to use to describe this cutoff, but something along these lines.
What are those two lines? Do you know what the formulas are?
Sorry?
Those two lines for the cutoff. One exponential, one not?
Yeah, I think it shows that a pure exponential cutoff is not a very good description of the data, and that this is the best fit.
A lot depends on that last point, I guess, right? So is it certain that it's cutting off?
There's no question that it's cutting off. I mean, if you try to fit it with a pure power law, the cascade is really bad. Now, whether you can really say that one form of the cutoff is favored over another is still... I think the error bars do become large over here, and it depends on a few points. But,
as I remember, these two curves are just to early data, and the flat one is to the latest data.
Yeah, this is from the last of the three papers that we have on the subject, which has
more data.
It's accelerating right now.
So the data from all 3 years are consistent, but just with the additional statistics, we get a better description of the spectrum.
If you write more, you get more high energy effects.
Which publication is this plot?
It's from this third one, 2007 paper. Yes. They have been different instances to the subject in the literature, but the most up-to-date one, taking into account the X-ray absorption and the column seen in H1 and CO, gives something around 1 kiloparsec, in which case the luminosity is 10 to the 34 ergs per second or so, brighter than what we saw for Cassie and the other ones. If you try to interpret this in a leptonic scenario where the synchrotron is from the same electrons which produce inverse Compton, you get a value of the magnetic field which is quite a bit lower than what is otherwise known from or suspected from the rim brightness, the rim thickness in X-rays. Another one very similar is GO852 or G266.2, or otherwise more familiarly known as Vela Junior. This is a very big shell, 2 degrees in diameter. It's called Vela Junior because it's superimposed on the Vela remnant, which is itself even bigger, 8 degrees in diameter, but it's probably only because it's further away, this one. Again, it has a somewhat, it was also seen by kangaroo. Again, it has a good spatial correlation with X-rays from Aska, and I believe in some parts, perhaps over here, that there are no data, which is why you don't see any emission in X-rays. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to have a very strong correlation with, this is an integrated CO. These are, again, the X-ray contours, and this is in galactic coordinates. This one is in RX, so you have to turn it. But anyway, over here is where you have a region of high density, and you don't see any particular enhancement of the TeV emission.
How do you know is the same distance, the cloud? How do you know that the high density region is the same is at the same distance as the remnant?
I believe this is integrated in the velocity range, which corresponds to the assumed distance for this object.
Basically, you're saying it's maybe not because there's no interaction, right? You said there's
well,
no
interaction. There's the question if it's 100 parsecs before or behind, right? So
it may be that it means that there's no interaction, but.
They didn't know.
This was an attempt to try to find where the matter is at the distance of the remnant, and there is no clear evidence for a direction, if you like. This one, with statistics we have, can be described as a power law, but there is evidence of a steepening at high energies. The high energy points are a bit below this. Not as significant as in RSS-15, but it's consistent with the same picture, that is that you have, in fact, cut off rather than a pure power law.
And that means it's at higher energy.
Say again? At higher energy.
It's at energy higher than for supernova 1006, or it's just the statistic is worse, and therefore... And the fact that it's so clear in 1006 and it's not clear here.
I mean, RX in 1713, you mean?
RX 1713.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm not sure if that's really true. It may be simply that we have less statistics. It's also a bit more complicated to do the spectral analysis because it's such a big source. You integrate more background. So. I'm not sure if there is a number, but I think that. I believe, to be checked, that it's consistent with the same kind of spectrum, with the same location of the cutoff as in RSS.
Do you have a show spectrum for this?
I don't have it in my slides, but it's in, certainly in the paper. You could have a look at it afterwards. So there are distances, various distances that have been proposed. If it's at the farthest distance that has been suggested, it is in comparable luminosity. And again, this statement doesn't depend on the distance, it's just a ratio of luminosities, and it gives, again, a magnetic field of order 10 microliters in leptonic scenario. The third one is one we heard about a few days ago, RCW86, or perhaps more properly called MSH14-63. This is a clear detection. There's a hint of shell morphology, but in fact, it's not statistically compelling. We would need more data in order to make a statement. Nonetheless, it seems consistent with the idea that it's a shell also in TV, as it, like it is in radio and X-rays. This, so here you have these contours, or at least a preliminary version of these contours, has contours superimposed on the XMM image, which you don't see very well, but the point of this picture is that the blue is non-thermal and the yellow is mostly thermal. There is a lot of thermal emission over here, which is a region where it starts to interact with denser material, if I'm not mistaken, and there is no particular enhancement of the TeV emission in that region, which you might expect if it was hadronic.
There's no curvature to the power law?
Sorry?
Is there any curvature to the power law?
I think there's not enough statistics to tell.
You mean curvature upwards or curvature downwards?
I don't care.
But he just said that there is evidence for some type of possible cutoff, right?
Yeah, I don't have theoretical prejudices on this, so.
I know,
but
we
only have one statement, so that limits the.
I understand. That's what I wanted to know.
There is indirect evidence. Well, if you want to interpret it as hadronic emission, there is indirect evidence for cutoff in the sense that this is relatively steep spectrum. And if you try to extrapolate this downward in energy, you get too much energy. So this means that if it's a hadronic emission, it has to flatten to something like spectrum index 2.
Everything looks like a power on one order of magnitude.
Which is compatible with the spectral data.
Right? But for Rydberg-Skonk, you also need to be beyond the peak, right?
You also need that?
For Rydberg-Skonk, this is also pretty soft.
Yeah, in general, it I'm not sure about this specific one. In general, it is rather difficult to fit the exact spectral shape within the Wisconsin in these
actions. Listen, I mean, obviously, you tend to fit the spectrum on the cutoff. So whatever slope you get, it's not the slope of the spectrum, really. It's the slope that you would infer if you tried to fit an exponential with a power law. It doesn't mean anything.
I know that, but for Rydberg-Skonk, you get a fairly peaked spectrum, typically, if you model that, and so you need to be well beyond that peak to get that type of power law fit.
Yeah, I don't know offhand about this, but
you can never
in principle, in a... In the leptonic scenario,
you remember what the X-ray spectrum is?
Yeah, usually it's around in photon index minus 3 or so. So that would translate to minus 2 alpha radio, which is
about. Well, anyway, so the X-ray spectral index is presumably on the cutoff of the superfine emission. Then if you're a slightly different place in the cutoff, maybe you can fit it. The only point is that, in principle, from the levels, you get a value of the magnetic field, and it may not be possible to fit this with the idea of the, yeah, both in amplitude and in the frequency. I don't know offhand about this one.
And you left, I'm sorry if I interrupted again, but you left the, in order to get to the statement on the field, you had to assume something on the photon target.
Yes. This is assuming CMB, and I believe it's extrapolating with the X-ray spectral index upward, I think. So there's some uncertainty. The idea is that if you want to compare the fluxes, you are not seeing exactly the same power law. This is presumably at lower energies, electrons, than the ones that are making X-ray synchrotron, which have a steeper spectral index. And somehow you have to interpolate between the two. It's not very sensitive to this.
There's a single zone model fitted about
X-ray
radio.
It's not very simplified anyway.
The target photons.
Target photons, CMB only.
Yeah, but that means that probably you don't make it high enough in energy. I mean, the overall structure may be, but if you try to actually fit the spectrum, it falls short by quite a bit.
In terms of location, you mean?
Yeah.
That maybe, I don't remember. I don't think we've...
You end up in the Kleinichina.
Well, anyway, I'll show an example of fitting on the first one. I don't remember if the same kind of exercise was tried in detail with this one. At the, well, the most favored distance in the literature, this turns out to be as luminous as the other ones, perhaps a bit less if it's closer in. The last and most recent one is a source, HESG-1731, which was discovered in the HES Galactic Plane Survey. It was initially considered unidentified. Then there was a radio shell coincident with this source. This is sort of a zoom of this region, found by Tian et al. In ATCA data. And subsequently, we took more data on this object. And this is a radial profile of the emitter, the HES emission in green. It is a stronger suggestion of limb brightening. That was the dots are the radial profile, and the green crosses, which maybe you have trouble seeing, are the HES data, but they suggest that it's limb brightened, although statistically significance is not very high. We are taking more data, and probably we can make a more definite statement about this soon. More interestingly, there were X-ray observations taken of a part of the shell over here. That's the XMM field of view. The contours are the radio contours, and you see rings of emission, and they turn out to be completely non-thermal. So this is another example of a shell which is, shows a TV shell-like morphology, which shows non-thermal X-rays, and in this case, like RG1713 Vela Jr., completely non-thermal X-rays as far as we can tell. No hint of thermal emission. Also, there turns out to be a gradient in absorption across the remnants, which suggests that it's behind a certain cloud, which we can find in the CO data. This gives a minimum distance to the object of around 3.5 kiloparsecs, and that implies that it's quite luminous and quite large. So these are the four TV shells, which are not historical, and then there's TV emission from this one and from this one as well. All these share a certain number of properties, that they have exclusively or dominantly non-thermal X-ray emission, except maybe Cassé. These larger and presumably older ones have weak radio synchrotron emission, and they'll have similar TV luminosities, a bit less for the historical one, which is perhaps, as we would expect, all other things being equal, that the particle acceleration is accumulating gradually the number of accelerated particles. Now, the big question is whether what we're seeing is leptonic or hadronic. The arguments in favor of the leptonic scenario is that you might have a more natural explanation for the correlation between synchrotron X-rays and the TV gamma ray morphology. Against is that it implies, in one's own model, a fairly low value of the magnetic field, and we have evidence from typically the narrowness of the synchrotron rims that, and other arguments that there should be B-field amplification well above this value. However, a possible way out is that TV shells appear to be quite a bit broader than the X-ray rims. And depending on what you think the explanation of this is, one explanation is that it's simply synchrotron losses of the electrons, in which case that doesn't solve our problem. But another is that there's B-field damping behind, rapid B-field damping behind the shock. In that case, the high-energy particles, electrons, survive much further down. They continue to make inverse Compton emission, even though they don't make any, they make a lot less synchrotron emission because the B-field has decreased. And it may be that this can be reconciled with the ratio of the synchrotron and inverse Compton in a model that takes into account the spatial dependence of the
B-field. So in what remnant do you actually see the significant event, the TV shell is wider?
And certainly in RXJ1713, the simple model tries to fit the emission that we see in the TV gamma rays to a shell of finite thickness, and the thickness is quite a bit larger.
And then Vela Jr.?
Vela Jr. Vela Jr. is much thinner, and I think I get these numbers in physical size. They're perhaps comparable, but I'm not completely sure how well the deconvolution of the VSF is taken into account.
Could you say what is true here? You expect a gradual steepening more towards the inside of the TV shells, because of course the electrons first cool down. And
yes.
The cooldown population is more to the inside, so it should be steeper if you are in the loss event part of the spectrum.
So you're saying that if it was really rapid decay of the magnetic field, that the radio profile would be different from what's seen in the data.
People have looked at spatial differences, I guess, but maybe not. It's maybe good to do a radial binning. Right?
For example, for Tycho, the comparing the profile in radio and X-ray suggested the magnitude damping or alone would not explain the both radio and X-ray simultaneously.
Yes.
So I think for other remnant as well, it is generally difficult to assure the we see the strong magnitude only in X-rays and in TVs we see weak magnitude. So I think we need to check carefully if this kind of model can account for the both radio and X-rays. So we need to take account of the radius.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that this actually works quantitatively. It hasn't been studied in sufficient detail. I'm just saying the caveat is that this number comes from a one-zone model, and probably that's not good enough. Yeah.
But I think Jakob was also alluding to the TeV emission. Yes. If you look at low energy, sort of below TeV, you know, 300, 400 GeV, as opposed to 2 TeV. Question whether or not you see a difference in the shell width.
That, well, sorry, in principle, yes.
That's the eggs are older and they should have.
That's an interesting question. It's not clear. Well, it takes sufficient statistics, which may be in the brightest one we have. It's also the PSF is varying with energy, so it's not so simple to get at. But in principle, it's something to study. Yeah, I completely agree.
For reference, what is the non-thermal X-ray emission? You said all this had bright non-thermal X-ray. What is the non-thermal X-ray luminosity compared to
I don't know the number of hand, but if you get values of 10 microgauss, that suggests that the X-ray emission is a factor of 10 or so more luminous than the inverse function.
Is that a theoretical statement or
Well, this expresses the ratio between the two, and for three microgauss it would be the same. So this is why I'm getting this number. But you should.
I'm asking what the observed number is.
This is derived from the observed number. I'm working backwards. But
okay. Usually, I remember that the peak in X-rays is in neutrino is higher than in.
That would be the zero order statement. Now you have to take into account that you're not seeing exactly the same part of the spectrum, and so it's a bit more tricky. I think the observed X-ray luminosity, because it's at higher energy, is a bit lower than what I just said.
Usually, again, so it's fine for the cooling to the CMB magnetic field 3 microgauss, right? That's the same thing as you say. So the peak should be the same as 3 microgauss.
So last point is it's difficult to fit the actual spectral shape, at least in a simple one-zone model. This is an illustration of that. Well, which you can't see very well, unfortunately. I'm sorry about that. But you need magnetic fields of order 10 micrograss, a bit less to fit the ratio. Now, this is an answer to your question. That's nu f nu, and that's the ASCA flux, and that's the Hess flux for 347.3. So it is indeed about a factor 10 higher, maybe a bit less than the TV luminosity for the same.
I'm sure you have figured it only with CMB photons, but if you take into account the rotation field properly, there's optical emission and infrared, quite important compared to CMB, you will get
different spectral shape, yes.
Well, actually, for RCW86, if you compare the radio flux for a given point to the X-ray flux, you can't fit it in a single power law with an exponential cutoff. You need some actually flattening of the spectral shape, which probably has its reflection also then in the. So here you take was a very simple power law with an exponential cutoff, right? But that doesn't really fit the radio and the X-ray data together for a, you know, what is supposed to be a single population, namely where the X-ray singleton emission is.
Anyway, so the point is only that a simple one-zone model with only CMB photons doesn't fit the shape very well, but there may be ways to do it with more sophisticated model. In the hadronic scenario, it's not a very big difficulty to, these are independent populations, but nonetheless, the spectral index of 2 that you assume here is the one that gives you the right spectral index for the electrons in the radio domain, assuming that electrons and protons are accelerated with the same spectral index. The caveat here, this requires relatively high density around RxJ1713, and I think the same statement is true around the other non-terminal shells. And this is one of the problems with this scenario. So, well, a caveat. One problem with the hadronic scenario is that there's no obvious correlation with the surrounding medium density, where it seems to be higher as far as we can tell, which you would expect, would tend to expect. One point is that all the objects I've discussed are steeper than 2. in the energy range where we observe them. That means either it's a cutoff or it's, well, most likely it means that it's a cutoff. And anyway, none of these accelerate particles all the way to the knee with a spectral index of 2 or 2.1 or whatever. They are all steeper than this in the energy where we observe.
How old are they?
CAS 8 and 06, then the other ones is a bit of a guess, but they are larger in physical size, and so they're probably a few thousand years old.
Maybe it's just the upper cutoff hasn't gotten there yet.
Or it has been there a long time ago.
Yeah, either one.
So the problem is that the phase space, I mean the range of times for which you get the knee is relatively narrow.
And
that depends on like damping, how strong, how fast the Pmax decreases in time. That depends on how strongly the field is damped with time. And so it could, you know, decrease slowly, could decrease very fast, and that again gives you a different spectrum of the Earth, but it affects, of course, also what you see at any given time.
So you're saying the acceleration to the knee happens and the particles are released, escape almost immediately, and whether you can catch one in the act is very difficult.
It's a simple-minded picture. You could imagine that Pmax increases during the free expansion phase and then decreases with some law after the beginning of the set of theta phase. So either you catch it, you know, during the time in which it is accelerating to the highest value of the Pmax, or you miss it.
Yeah, the simple fact remains that none of the ones, well, it's six or so that we see, and none of them is currently accelerating particles all the way up to the knee. So whether it meant that it did before or that it will later is for you to judge. I think the older ones tend to be around 10,000 years old.
Moreover, we're talking about the factor of 10, right? I mean, 10 TeV means that the accelerator was at 100 TeV or more, right? So we're talking 10 to 14 instead of 10 to 15.
Well, I would say that that's a factor of 30, but
it's a little bit more. I mean, most of them, when you fit a parallel, you already get something steeper than 2. So, and then you have, for those that you don't see so sensitively, you just have a spectrum from a few hundred GeV to a few TeV. So the cutoff sits really at a TeV. That's the more sort of.
Now, the fields that he has presented until now hold the cutoff at roughly 10 TeV.
Yeah,
right? Which means a cutoff in the protons.
Well, it depends exactly how you describe the shape, but anyway, it's less than 10 TeV, which means that the cutoff in the protons is around 10 to 14.
For most of the weak ones, CAS A or so, you don't even have a single spectral point at 10 TeV. They're all below. So this is where you measure the spectrum.
Well, you typically have a point at least at 10 TeV, if not a bit higher. But anyway, it's no more than 10 to the 14, the cutoff in protons in this interpretation, and that's a factor of 30 below the knee, as far as I'm concerned.
But you have to remember, if you accelerate iron, you have a factor of 26.
That's true.
Which goes
at the knee, most people would say that it's still protons, the iron.
Uranium, you're really high now.
I presume you mean 10 to 14 EV, not 10 to 14 TeV.
Yes.
The observations at the knee are not accurate enough to do what you just said. I think there's still...
Well, there's observations above the knee that suggest that the composition is getting heavier. So if it's getting heavier above the knee, the most natural explanation is that the knee is a proton knee.
It starts below that.
And that you get an iron knee 26 times higher.
Yeah. There is another point, that is, it depends on... the energy conversion of energy into cosmic rays is increasing with time. If Pmax is close as high as the knee, the total flux, the total energy which has gone into accelerated particles is not as high as in this situation in which, you have also to balance the effect of total energy, which is channeled.
So you're saying even if you do get to the knee, it's not integrated spectrum of
the
protons.
The luminosity may be smaller, by factor, say, some 10, maybe, than in that region. Then
means you're saying this doesn't prevent an e to the minus 2 spectrum from escaping from the remnant. even if you're saying the integrated spectrum inside the remnant is less, is steeper than e to the minus 2.
No, this is consistent also with spectra, also flatter than p to minus 2, p to minus 4.
You know what, I find that, I mean, you haven't done so all your points, but one of your points is, of course, the lack of thermal x-rays, that one might mean. Well, it's actually very weird if you think about thermal x-rays. Okay, so let's say the temperature is very low because of shock.
Yeah, that is right?
The
forward
shock. What about reverse shock? Why don't we see shock detector in the fundaments? They shouldn't accelerate cosmic rays as much as the forward shock. So shouldn't we see thermal x-rays from the reverse shock region?
That's not obvious, right?
Okay? Well, I'm not sure.
The magnetic field in the ejecta is extremely low.
Yeah, so we don't see, that's what I'm saying. So we're not accelerating cosmic rays in the reverse shock. Where is the thermal x-rays from the reverse shock?
The thermal
x-rays from the reverse shock, right? That's actually a weird thing if you think about it.
Can say you should see it.
I'm thinking about RSA 7030, the ones that we are always discussing, the thermal x-rays, why don't we also see some x-rays from the reverse region, unless they are very old and, you know, but these guys, but you can't explain away the thermal x-rays, even at the forward shock, by saying the temperature is too low. We did that calculation. You get always some. Even with just Coulomb collisions, nothing else. With strong shock acceleration, you heat electrons enough to start radiating. They don't have to come into equilibrium, and they radiate stronger.
They also do. The Coulomb collisions is just much faster, right? So increase.
That's the minimum heating that you can assume. And with that, you have enough heating to produce thermal x-rays.
No, I mean, all supernova remnant density is fine. The reverse.
So,
but usually a metal rich, so you get bright ones, and that's the young remnants you see.
Because in Tycho, you see the iron line, so you see the rubber shock.
Yes.
I think the reverse shock, that depends also on the age that you think it is and then the velocity. But the point here was only that if you want to explain these as hadronic emission, you need relatively high densities, and then there's a question as to why you don't see any thermal x-rays from the forward shock. There are limits on the density from the lack of thermal emission, but these assume that temperature is high enough that you see it in x-rays. If you have some way of explaining why the electrons would be a lot cooler than that, this is not necessarily an upper limit, and the density can be quite a bit higher. However, if the density is high, this also means that they are older for the same physical size, so quite a bit older. So distance plays a big role in this, and in many cases, the most precise distances that we get are if you're comparing proper motions and temperature behind the shock, and this assumes shock-term conditions without cosmic rays. So it's better to have a more robust estimates of the distance, but typically these are less precise. That's all about TV shells. I want to spend a little time discussing another category of TV sources associated with supernova remnants. That's those that are interacting with molecular clouds. One good example of this is W28. This is, here you see a radio map. The circle is the size of the remnant. There are three sources here, which I won't discuss in too much detail, but the one that's interesting right now is this one, which is at the rim of W28. It's coinciding with an enhancement in radio emission and with the Nigrid source, and I guess with the Fermi source now. I haven't actually checked. What's interesting is also that you can find an appropriate velocity range CO cloud at this position, and there are OH masers. I'm not sure if there's one over here. There's certainly OH masers over here, which are the signature of a shock going through the molecular cloud. So all kinds of indications that this cloud is actually being overtaken by a shock of the supernova remnant.
Sorry, what is the circle?
That's just to illustrate more or less where the remnant is. It was, you can see what it really looks like in the radio map, which I just showed. So it's not really a perfect circle, but it describes more or less where the remnant is. So, to guide your eye, it would have been better to put the radio contours probably. So this is 1801, it's this source over here. It again has a steep spectrum, quite steep spectrum in this case, although the statistical errors are large. It's not compatible with being a pure extrapolation down to lower energies because this is the egress flux. The luminosity is lower than things that we've been discussing so far, but that's not very surprising. If you think that only a fraction of the cosmic rays might be interacting with this cloud. Another example, which I'll discuss before thinking a bit more about the interpretation, is IC443. This was discovered by MAGIC and has since been confirmed by Veritas, which actually measures the extension of this. So there is this source inside supernova remnant IC443. It coincides with a peak in the CU density, which is shown here in blue contours. There is a OH measure. It doesn't correspond with the pulsar wind nebula, which is in this remnant. So, and again, there's an associated egret source. And again, it has a steep spectrum and a relatively low luminosity. So we have these interesting objects where we see TV emission from clouds which appear to be overtaken by a shell of a supernova. This is very interesting because in principle it provides a probe of the cosmic rays that are being accelerated there. Here we have what we didn't have in the TV shells, that is a very good correlation with the matter density and the TV emission that could tend to suggest that it's hadronic emission, although molecular clouds also have very dense internal photon fields, and this doesn't rule out that you can explain it with a leptonic scenario. But going for now with the idea that it's hadronic, they again have steep and even steeper spectra than the shells that we've been discussing previously in this energy range. So the question is whether this is actually probing the spectrum of currently accelerated particles in this shell. The fact is that when the shock enters the molecular cloud, it slows down. And it's quite plausible that, in fact, the fact that the shock is interacting with the molecular cloud changes the spectrum of the accelerated particles. So it may be that in these molecular clouds, the currently accelerated particles have a relatively low cutoff or a steep spectrum, but that doesn't tell you anything about what the shock might be doing over here. So the suggestion is that these probes reveal a steep spectrum, or if you want, a relatively low cutoff in the spectrum of accelerated cosmic rays, but the caveat is that the probe may actually be modifying the shock, in which case you're not learning anything about the shock at other places. There are a few other two or three candidate objects of this type. And these two cases which I showed, the angular size of the remnant is quite big and it's relatively easy to pinpoint the location of the TV emission. In the other ones, they tend to be smaller. In their CTB37A, there is W51. Angular size is smaller and it's more difficult to have the angular resolution to say that it's really coming from the place where we know that there's a molecular cloud interaction with the remnant. In at least two of these, there are also pulsar wind nebulae, and it's not clear whether the emission is from the molecular cloud or the pulsar wind nebula. That's what I wanted to say about the SNR molecular cloud interactions. For the last part of the talk, I want to say something more about super bubbles. So this is going a bit outside of the box, and saying that maybe, from a theoretical point of view, maybe we're looking at the wrong problem entirely if we want to explain galactic cosmic rays. Well, I don't know if this summary is really helpful. What I wanted to talk about is this one. In fact, what we've been looking at are isolated supernova remnants, but most of the core collapse supernova progenitors, massive stars, are not isolated, but they are born in from giant molecular clouds into OB associations. And typically, the combined energy inputs of the stellar winds from these young and massive stars, or a few successive supernovae, will turn this ensemble of stars into one big bubble. That is, if you have the typical distance is such that if you have a few supernovae, they will overlap and make one big supernova, if you like, or a super bubble. It turns out that the energy input in the stellar winds before they go supernova may be enough to achieve this already. That is, the stellar winds, again, are powerful enough to collide, to flush out all the material that's in between the stars and make a big evacuated super bubble. If you look at the stellar wind output integrated over the line of a typical massive star, it's not very far from the 51 Earths, so it's not clear which of the two processes is dominant. But nonetheless, the result is that these massive stars are not in a typical interstellar medium. They are typically, at the moment where they go supernova, inside a hot superbubble. There are estimates in the literature saying that something like 75% of all supernovae, and so this is true for core collapse supernovae. Type 1As are old stars which can travel quite some distance away from their formation sites before exploding, and they typically explode in a standard interstellar medium, but they're a small fraction of the total supernova rate. And most of these ones occur in superbubbles, so in total something like 3/4 from various estimates should occur in superbubbles. So in fact, if you look at the historical ones, Cassie is the only one where we have a bright isolated remnant around the core collapse supernova remnant. Tycho was a 1A, 1006 was a 1A, Kepler was probably a 1A. The Crab was a type 2, but it doesn't show a shell. And maybe because it exploded into a hot, tenuous medium. And Higdon and Lingenfelder argue that the fact that you don't see any other bright shell type supernova remnant as bright as Cassie suggests that it's very untypical for a core collapse supernova to explode inside a relatively dense interstellar medium.
But have we seen any examples?
Well, the idea. The big question, I mean, the big problem with this scenario is that it's relatively hard to establish observationally. The idea, as I understand it, is that if you explode inside a tenuous medium, you would not see very much at all, certainly not in the radio. And the Crab and other isolated clarions may be exactly examples of that. That is, that you know that there was a core collapse supernova, it left behind a pulsar.
I think actually for they have looked at absorption data towards Beckmann sources as well, to see if they see
to see the explosion itself. Or
I think they didn't see anything. People have tried to look for a shell or evidence of, say, sort of freely expanding ejecta still inside the bubble.
Is the Crab in a super bubble?
I think actually the standard explanation, well, I'm not sure how standard it is, but for the Crab, it was a low explosion energy. And so the pulsar wind nebula just took over the ejecta.
Well, there certainly have been various explanations offered as to why the Crab doesn't show a shell, but I believe one that's still plausible is the idea that it's expanding into too tenuous a medium, and that's why it's not being seen.
There's always that it's low density out there.
Okay, but I thought that people have now sort of looked at freely expanding ejecta and absorption towards Beckmann stuff.
I haven't followed the most recent stuff. The attempt to identify the density into which it's expanding, the most interesting, and it's quite plausible, identification is the Hester's point that the filamentary material inside the nebula is likely formed by a really Taylor instability of stuff on the boundary, and he's used HST to look at the stuff that on the boundary and saying there's some number he has for the amount of the from the line emission on right on the boundary of the nebula. I don't remember what it is though.
Well, I mean, can you assume, I don't know the answer, that's why I'm asking, is the Crab in a superbubble, or is it definitely not in a superbubble?
I don't think there's an OB association necessarily.
Well, the nearby massive stars that are going to
supernova. I never heard of any, but that's,
So the only examples we have before the Crab supernova are not in superbubbles, I guess.
Well, there's
that's true, but In general, you would not see these optically. There's typically, if you are in the process of star formation or not
accurate. Well, you would see the pulsars being there. They left behind.
It seems legal.
Yeah, I mean, one problem I've always had with this estimate is that why is it that none of the historical supernovae are observed to be in supernovae as far as we know?
And why are they all seem to be type 1As even,
right?
Exactly.
That's 75%, of course, if you ask Higden and Lingfeld, they say it's 85% or higher.
But you can probably explain all this by saying that the core collapse do occur in superbubbles, and that these are still embedded in at least some molecular cloud and in the galactic plane, so you don't see them optically because they're too far to extinct.
So what's the new evidence? So that's what's interesting.
So until recently, .. You're leaving us hanging.
If this is true,
the perils of college.
If this picture is true, it means that essentially most of the supernova energy input into the galaxy, which you want to accelerate cosmic rays, is liberated in these superbubbles. So how can we? Is it possible to accelerate cosmic or galactic cosmic rays inside superbubbles? There are different things that all of which have question marks over here. One question, which I don't know the answer to, is what happens if you take standard shock acceleration theory at a supernova environment, but explode it in a very tenuous medium? Can you still accelerate efficiently? How long do you have to accelerate before the shock dilutes into the thermal medium? I put here the numbers for the hot phase of the interstellar medium. The idea is that the hot phase is, in fact, it's not clear whether this is representative of superbubble at any given time, but the hot phase occurs because you have these superbubbles emerging at different places in the galaxy, making holes. Other things that have been suggested is that the winds of the massive stars themselves and their collisions can provide shocks and may accelerate particles. Another idea is that, in fact, you have these various interactions of these winds and successive supernova remnant shocks. That gives rise to a lot of turbulent energy and multiple shocks, and maybe you can use this to accelerate cosmic rays. I think these ideas are not worked out in anywhere near the detail that we have for shock acceleration theory. But the big problem in taking all this seriously is that there's not a whole lot of observations until recently. So a couple of years ago, there was the discovery of a TV source associated with a star cluster called Westerlin 2. The emission, one idea was that you might get a TV emission from these, one of these is a binary Wolf-Rayet star. It turns out that that's not what you see. You see something extended with a relatively steep spectrum. There's been a lot of uncertainty about the distance to this cluster, but if you take H1 absorption against the H2 region and the corresponding CO clouds, you can estimate, narrow down the distance to something like 6 kiloparsecs, in which case it's a fair bit more luminous than any of the individual SNRs that we've been talking about previously in TV gamma rays. The emission is consistent with, well, it's not really very clear from this picture, but there is a radio shell, which is called a blister. The cluster itself is over here, is very small, and the idea is that this bubble is being blown. It's kind of an outbreak-like bubble being created by the cluster. Radius is relatively large, so this seemed like a relatively convincing association, but in order to study this in a bit more detail, one would want a more massive and more powerful cluster to also emit TV gamma rays. And so this
is that it seemed to be the combination of the stellar winds that's producing the acceleration, or
so again, the integrated power of the stellar winds and of successive supernova explosions is comparable. So it's probably some combination of stellar winds and early supernova explosions, which is the dominant one. It's not completely clear, but nonetheless, the energy input is proportional to the number of young massive stars that you have.
Isn't there a Mediterranean cluster?
I don't remember if it's in this one or another one, but yes, there at least one of these has a magnetar candidate, which is an indication that some massive star already went supernova. So there's Westerlund 1, which is an extremely massive star cluster. It has 24 well-fired stars, which the previous one had only a couple. It has 80 blue supergiants. It is one of the most massive star clusters in the galaxy. And so we've been spending some time looking at this. The cluster is this little star asterisk over here. It's relatively compact. And it took us a while to realize that, in fact, all this emission that we see over here, if you integrate it, it has quite a high significance around the more than 10 sigma, might actually be associated with this small object over here. This is an attempt to make a radio profile away from it, and you can see that there's emission extending over up to about 1 degree from this object. And it's not clear whether it's really limb brightened like this picture suggests. But the clincher is that there is also already, there was already in the literature, a claim that there is a shell over here in H1 at a certain velocity, which corresponds to a distance of 4 kiloparsecs, which is compatible to the distance of the cluster, which is claimed to be associated with this stellar cluster. And so you have VHE emission filling a shell, which is seen in neutral gas, and this has a huge radius of 60 parsecs, but in fact, if you add up all the power and the stellar winds that the object that you estimate to be there, it's more than enough to blow up a bubble of this size in the surrounding medium. So all this evidence is consistent with the idea that filling this super bubble over here, or at least overlapping with it in exactly an extent, is this VHE emission. Don't have a spectrum yet for this. It's a big source and it's a bit complicated to do spectral analysis. I think we're first trying to identify blobs, but I think it's better to do the whole thing. So stay tuned for that number.
What I understand actually from the supergodal models from Beecroft is that you get a lot of flat spectrum.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's interesting to compare.
But it's a difference.
So one where we do have a spectrum, it tends to be relatively stable.
But I think it's a slightly different thing. So in the model of Beecroft, what you have is that you inject these particles from one supernova, and these are the same cosmic rays that are overtaken and accelerated by a second one and a third and so on. So you can actually show analytically very easily that the asymptotic overlap of infinite number of shots gives an asymptotic spectrum, which is e to minus 3 halves. And that's what they get, basically.
In 3D or in...
What?
In 3D or in a 1D approximation? It should be...
I don't know if it's a dependence on dimensionality. But this seems to be something different, right? This is not like the shells are actually accelerating in the volume in which they are. They are basically generating a super shell, in a sense.
Well, yeah, so you should be careful about what this picture is suggesting. If you look at this, it's consistent with the TV emission really being diffused inside this shell. So it may be that the TV emission is just filling.
It scales with the mass. So you would expect, I don't know, there are order, 100 stars in there?
More
compared with the previous case. So in that case, you've got 10 to 34? A few times 10 to 34. Here it's 10 to 39. It's five orders.
Okay, then that's the power in the winds. Then there's a question of the conversion efficiency into particles, and then the conversion efficiency of the particles into gamma rays. So this is not... But the equivalent number for Westerlin 2, I believe, is... a few times 10 to the 37, so maybe a factor 30 offhand. I'm not sure I remember this number exactly.
But it's the number.
Certainly of the right order, the factor difference to explain the difference in size, assuming that they're expanding into similar density medium.
So if you would guess this super shell is actually expanding in the normal interstellar medium, then not in the...
Typically, for these, you assume density of around 100 per centimeter cubed.
So it's not really expanding in this tenuous hot medium that you were talking about.
The tenuous hot medium is inside.
So in fact, from some point on, and after some time, basically it shouldn't make any difference if you have a shell expanding in a hot medium or a super shell expanding in a normal interstellar medium or quasi-normal interstellar medium. What I'm saying is that I guess the medium upstream of this super shock.
Mm-hmm. It's not the shock value, by the way. It's an expanding. What? It's an expanding shell, and I think the expansion velocity is such that it's subsonic. But,
okay, so it cannot. Okay, so it's not.
The super one of the shock. Problems is actually that you see a shell in H1, right? It means that there's some radiative magnetism going on. Huh.
So the idea is the hot mesium is inside this bubble, and this bubble is the cold gas that's being pushed away by the hot bubble.
There's another case, that is it 30 to the wrong C or something? There's this X-ray shell that shows non-thermal emission on one side, and it's also...
But which has been claimed to be a super bubble, yeah.
Then it must be the high shock velocity.
So the density you said is on the order of 100?
Second?
The density.
I don't know if it's known. That's just what's typically put in these estimates, but... in principle, from this H1, you should get a density, and I'm not sure what the number is. So we have at least a couple of massive star clusters, which match some structure or shell or blister in the radio or H1, which coincides with the TV emission. It's not clear whether the TV emission is lit brightening or not. There are a couple more candidates. This first unidentified TV source has been proposed to be associated with an OB association, at least part of an OB association. One of the unidentified high source may be associated with a star cluster, although here I think the energy requirements are quite a bit more severe. So we have direct evidence that superbubbles accelerate particles are at least to 10 to the 14 electron volts. The question is whether what we're seeing is hadronic or leptonic is quite uncertain at this point. I mean, there is certainly a lot of mass around. There is a nearby molecular cloud in the case of Westerlund 2, which is quite massive. But you would expect then the emission to be dim brightened, at least in the most simple picture where the particles fill the super bubble, they will interact at the edge of the super bubble with dense matter. On the other hand, there are certainly intense photon fields around from the stars, from the H2 region, which is reprocessing these stellar photons into much more numerous photons. The infrared emission from the clouds. So you could certainly think that infrared Compton emission might be relatively easy to do as well. But the questions which I think we should be thinking about theoretically is that, in principle, if these estimates are correct, most of the galactic supernova energy deposition is inside such superbubbles. So one question is, what is the efficiency of SNR shock acceleration in such a hot medium? And more generally, can other mechanisms, interacting stellar winds or turbulence, be more efficient than its shock acceleration? That's my last slide, and it's exactly 1 hour.
Aside from the question of that the acoustic Mach number won't be so high if you pop fire into a medium of, say, temperature...
If you have a certain environment inside a hot medium, yes. Mm.
I don't understand what is likely to be any seriously different about a shock acceleration in such a hot medium versus a 10 to the 4th Kelvin medium. I mean, when shock acceleration was first proposed, everybody was all excited about doing it in a hot medium.
A million degrees is not that hot.
And, but a million degrees is, so the acoustic Mach number was, instead of 1,000 is 100. I mean, it's a big number, and I think the mechanism only cares about having a strong shock. And also the other issue about Alvanic Mach numbers is, depending on what you thought about the magnetic field and such a... such a low density.
Yeah, well, one thing I had at the back of my mind is that at least in a typical interstellar magnetic field, you don't get to the knee, and the way that's been proposed around that seems to work relatively well is this magnetic field amplification. I'm not sure the magnetic field amplification works as well when the Mach number is quite a bit lower, but I don't know. This would be for...
Maybe we don't understand very well the benefit, but on the other hand, you could have these strong winds which carry their own field. So, there could be.
Yeah, it's not clear that the magnetic field in a super bubble is a typical interstellar field. It may well be higher.
probably, I think that the second question has two aspects which are clearly different. One is whether the efficiency for cosmic ray acceleration integrated over the supernova time is large enough. And in this respect, I agree with John that in principle there shouldn't be any dramatic differences. On the other hand, a separate question could be, could I see it? Because at that point you are seeing what happens at any given time, and if the density is very low, the rate of interactions could be relatively small, and so you don't see it even if it is an efficient accelerator. So there are two different businesses. One is why I don't see it. The other one is it enough for accelerating cosmic rays?
Well, one issue with is it enough is that presumably you have less time to do it in the sense that the
Depends
where you think it
is. You have more time.
I mean, the supershells, once you really form them,
it's the time that you have to do it is before it becomes set up.
Is in the H1, that's how you find them. But the volume that's contained is quite huge compared to standard size of supernovae. And, this scale you're looking at, is that's kind of the scale people argue is the size a supernova remember would be if you were were such a thing as a general phase 3 medium, and you were always popping off into a widely distributed million degree 10 to the minus 3 per cc gas. The supernova rounds get very big. It takes quite a while to get there. If you really wanted to find 10 to 15 TeV, you're waiting, up to a million years before you get up to that.
Right. So if you have
it becomes also subsonic at some point. So I'm not sure when that happens, if that's before or after it turns into the setup.
It's random. It's random. If you read the McKee-Ostreicher model and the things that derive from it, people thrash that a lot. It takes around a million years in the supernova to evaporate. And it survives as a setup, like phase for much longer than the conventional numbers are, because the radiative, the point about not being able to see it is another way of saying that the radiative efficiency is very low.
There's another strong constraint, and that's from the cosmic ray composition. And this is measured at lower energies, of course, but you cannot produce a large fraction of cosmic rays from super bubble material if it's enriched in core collapse elements in the massive star wings.
I've heard this argument made the other way. That is that, in fact, there are enhancements of a certain number of isotopes and species in the cosmic.
One isotope, which is neon-22, which yes. Tells you that's a Wolf Rayet compound. But if you analyze all the cosmic ray elements, all the compositions, and the other isotopes, which show very little.
Well, there's also all these first-liners, inquisition, potential, or volatility biases, which suggest...
Right, which is telling you that you're accelerating dust grains. You must turn dust grains into cosmic rays. And that's another thing that, if you're in a very hot superbubble medium, might be difficult.
But what about the shock precursor that is leading the same thing, and even 10 to the 6 Kelvin as well, right? So what is the difference between having a shock precursor in terms of the subshock and being a hot density or in a hot medium?
Pasquale mentioned the most important issue, and it's one we have least handle on, is what's the damping like?
You find less than 10 to the 6 precursor.
Well, the thing about a precursor is that dust, you don't have enough time to, even if it's hot in the precursor, you don't have enough time to
dust.
We see.
The idea, and actually, the hot superbubble may not be a problem either, because the densities are so low. And it may take a long time for the...
Sure, sure.
We see
Should we break for coffee?